I'm Mike Peskin for Leonard Lopate. Ivy League education hit. Job on Wall Street during boom times hit. Well, some would stick, but he hit. Join a card counting ring? That's a bust, right? Actually, the bust came later. Josh Axelrod did learn the intricacies of blackjack, joined a ring of card counters who plied their trade all over the country. His new book is Repeat Until Rich, a professional card counter's chronicle of the blackjack wars. Thanks for coming in.
Mike, thank you for having me.
So when you were in your boring Wall Street job, did you go to casinos? Did you gamble as a hobby?
No, I didn't. I didn't have much interest in the world of gambling before I began to immerse myself in the intricacies of card counting.
Were you a math guy?
Not at all.
Really?
And the fact that I ended up on Wall Street is itself, to me personally, knowing myself as I do, which I understand that you and the listeners do not, that's the most staggering part of the entire story, honestly, is that I ever had a job in Wall Street to begin with.
So international card counting ring, yeah, I could buy that, but Wall Street,
Given my interests and proclivities, the Wall Street thing is that, if anything, to me, it's a barometer of exactly how loosely the money was flowing at that time, that I was able to find a job in that world.
So what was your background? What did you study? What kind of thinker were you?
I wasn't one, although I aspired to be. I had a degree nominally in philosophy, which essentially meant that I several times a year would reread Descartes' Meditations on First Philosophy and nothing else. And even that I didn't read very well. I was not a good philosophy student. My interests were in the liberal arts, but very liberal to the extent that they were even liberated from any particularly... I wasn't a great student.
All right.
Rigorous course of study.
So how did you go from I think therefore I am to hit a six against a dealer's 10?
Well, I mean, you have to do something with your six. It's a terrible hand, right?
Yeah, I know.
Met a guy at a party who, at the moment that I happened to first encounter him, was uttering words about blackjack and card counting. And I had heard that phrase, card counting, but I had, I think as many people do, some sort of fanciful notion of what it might be. I thought it related to poker. I thought it related to specifically poker in the Old West for some reason. I thought a card counter had a cowboy hat on and would strut into a saloon with sawdust on the floors and would take everybody's money at a poker game using perfect recall of every card played and stuff like that. I didn't know it applied specifically to blackjack or that it was actually, in practice, relatively a simple thing to do.
Right. So it's relatively simple. We could explain the concept, and you do in the book, which is on a blackjack table, they have many, many decks of cards at once. And so as the cards come out, it changes the odds of the cards that are still in the deck. And a good player, if he can figure out the odds of the cards still in the deck, might want to increase his bets. Am I getting it about right?
About right, yes. I would just add that that a good player isn't trying to figure out in the sense of hunch work or approximate estimations. You only have worthwhile information if you're counting cards using a legitimate established system. You shouldn't improvise this stuff.
Right. So exactly. And so what you do in the system I've heard is you just take note of the low cards and you take note of the high cards and you add one for the low cards, you subtract one for the high cards or vice versa. And what you want is to get a situation where there are a lot of aces and tens in the deck. You want to bet in that situation.
That's correct. You're looking for decks where that concentration of those cards is abnormally high.
Right. So to get there, if you're just an individual doing it, hard to make money if you could count as just you yourself going to a blackjack table and hoping that every once in a while the odds come out in your favor?
Well, you can do it on your own. And to this day, there are people out in the world who are applying their trade as essentially professional card counters without the benefit of a team. Teams bring with them a lot of both psychological and economic benefits. One of the biggest barriers to entry for card counting is that in order to make really any money, you have to have a significant bankroll, cash capital that you're prepared to risk gambling. And ordinary people who have sufficient capital to get started in the first place got that money from somewhere, usually by plying a reasonable trade with a lot more security and stability and arguably meaning in the world than card counting will ever be. And so most people who are in the financial position to do this don't want to because they have other things to do with their time and their money.
Right, and it takes a lot of effort. So did you start counting cards and then say, let me look for a team, or was there a team waiting for you if you learned how to count cards?
There was a team that was decidedly not waiting for me, which is the well-known MIT blackjack team. At the time, even in the blackjack world at the time, MIT had been heard of. There were sort of myths and stories about them. The book about them that sort of made them very well-known was not published yet.
That was Bringing Down the House.
Yeah. The person that I met at this particular event, who later became a friend of mine and trained me to count cards, had gone to MIT and had trained and played with that team. He was not an active player going every weekend. He went on a handful of trips in the course of his undergraduate career, but he had studied it thoroughly and had wonderful stories about it and a lot of excitement about it. And so I learned from him and then proceeded to go on a couple of trips where I attempted to check out to the MIT's team's then standards, which were extremely, extremely high. To this day, having advanced considerably with my blackjack skills and in fact earned a living playing this game for 5 years, I am not at all confident that I would pass the full MIT checkout, because that test was really extremely difficult. More so, I would argue, than is actually necessary to get money out of casinos.
Do you have to know a guy to apply for the test? Is it like the French Foreign Legion? How do you even make yourself known to an established team like the MIT team?
You can't really. Yeah. I mean, I've been increasingly, now that I'm sort of talking to people more in a public setting about blackjack, I'm getting questions like that. And the reality is, with my group, certainly the group that I call Massaud in the book, we simply would not have countenance the possibility of recruiting somebody who came to us. We would go to people who were already friends of ours who we trusted.
Right. You wouldn't take in an outsider. That makes sense. But I think we maybe jumped the story a little bit, and I should say that I'm talking with Josh Axelrod, who's written a book called Repeat Until Rich, A Professional Card Counter's Chronicle of the Blackjack Wars, which is your team. How'd you get the team? How'd you train the team up so that you were ready to take on casinos? Massaud, tell me about them.
So the person who I call Gary in the book, who had been an MIT player, while he was in New York, got to know through some MIT referrals of another team that was doing similar things to what MIT had done. They were at that time a good bit smaller than MIT had been. They were extremely active. So at the time that I was sort of trying occasionally to take these checkouts with MIT, MIT was not actually playing that much. And in fact, they'd split into various factions. So there were more than one MIT blackjack group in operation at that time. This other group, Massaud, was increasingly active, and they were playing all the time. Their approach was extremely aggressive. So where some players tend to get nervous about what's called heat, which is countermeasures, reactions.
When people at the casino maybe are on to you, or you think they're on to you and try to stop you.
Exactly. Yeah. And in fact, some card counters, in fact, some who have perfectly legitimate and successful card counting careers, make it a point to try to avoid detection always. Try to have years long, 5 or 10 year or even longer careers in the casinos without being identified as card counters. Massaud's approach was entirely different. They went in with an objective of making money immediately using fairly blatant techniques. And one of the challenges, I should point out, with card counting is that in order to get money out of casinos, you must do things that will make you look like a card counter. The subtler you are, and you can try to change your approach, what we're basically talking about is varying the size of your bets. To win as a card counter, you bet small when the deck is unfavorable, which is most of the time, and then a lot more during those brief windows of opportunity. And that's an obvious thing. And the more aggressive you are about it, the bigger the differential between your small bet and your big bet. A, the more money you'll win, because that your edge is a direct effect of that bet spread, but also the easier it will be for casinos to identify.
Sure, so you're sitting there going 25, 25, and you might go through three shoes, and then all of a sudden you're putting down, if the table limit allows it, $1,000 bets. And that will make a pit boss or a dealer, everyone, to go, this guy might know what he's doing.
25 to 1,000 should and generally will, and I think it's a great way to play.
Okay, but MIT would do a lot of things where maybe they'd be more subtle about it. They would, first of all, try to wear a lot of disguises so no one knew who they were.
Well, I should point out that when you talk about the MIT team also, you're talking about more of a blackjack tradition than a unitary team. They had been founded in the late 1970s.
The MIT philosophy.
Right, the MIT philosophy. The MIT school, as it were, of card counting. So there's not one thing that they did. They tried different things over various times, over various periods. There may be MIT affiliates who are still in operation today who I don't know anything about.
Right.
Some of whom may be doing brilliant things that are totally unrecognizable by casinos. I don't necessarily know.
But Massaud wants to go in, hit him hard, and take him down. And if they are on to us, who cares? We have their money.
Exactly. It was our stated philosophy that the natural end of a blackjack session is when they throw you out.
Okay. Now we got to talk about legality. Different states, it's legal and illegal, or is it actually legal everywhere, but it's also legal for casinos to throw anyone out for whatever reason they want?
It's legal everywhere. Card counting is playing blackjack well.
Yeah.
So to make it illegal is intellectually the same thing as making skilled chess play illegal, saying you can't think that way at chess.
Because card counting is in your head. If you use an outside device, if you use a clicker or a computer, obviously that's illegal. But card counting is something that you do in your brain, and that's fine.
That's exactly correct.
But if you're running a casino, what are you trying to do to stop it?
Well, if you're running a casino, actually, you want there to be card counting. This is where the entire enterprise becomes a little more complicated than people tend to expect.
Yeah.
The history of blackjack And blackjack, as it exists today and as you see it in casinos from Atlantic City to Las Vegas today, is a consequence and has an intimate relationship with the phenomenon of card counting. Card counting made blackjack the number one casino table game in terms of revenue, which is it still is today. Casinos make more money. They have far more poker tables cumulatively. But the house does not book action in poker, right? They charge a fee, a rake for your time at the tables. They book action at blackjack, and they make more money at it than they do at any other table game. That did not used to be the case. Before the book that introduced card counting to the general population, which was called Beat the Dealer by Ed Thorpe, before that book came out, craps was the number one table game for revenue. It was much more popular. People thought of blackjack as a sucker's game, in part because they didn't really know how to play it, and it was a sucker's game if you were using the incorrect strategy. And what Thorpe said was, lo and behold, there actually is a legitimate, sensible, learnable way for making money at this game. And what that did was not only propel a few people like me and Mossad and MIT and other players to actually get their, you know, affairs together to take down casinos in a serious way, it also inspired a lot of people who were not that educated, who didn't take the time to educate themselves, and who got caught up in the same myth that every other gambler wants to get caught up in, which is, I can win at a casino game. In blackjack, that myth happens to be more credible because it's fundamentally true, but it's not true for most players who don't, in fact, learn their stuff.
Mm-hmm. So will you say so? It's a cat and mouse game. The way the casino games have changed to take into account that a lot of people are counting cards. How have they changed? What have they done?
They've been doing things continually, and they still are to this day. Panicked in 1964, a couple of years after Thorpe's book came out. For a while, casinos didn't understand they didn't understand that the book system was in fact a legitimate one. Mm-hmm. In the 1960s, just like today, you can walk into a bookstore and find countless totally bogus books hawking spurious systems that will cause you to lose money.
You can find these books about roulette and craps just to give you an idea of how ridiculous it is to try to outsmart a roulette wheel.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
You can beat roulette if you're prepared to risk jail time because it's certainly a cheatable game, and some people have made money doing that, but you can't legitimately, lawfully beat roulette. So casinos in 1964 tried changing their blackjack rules in such a way that they hoped would make card counting unappealing by increasing the house edge a lot. What they found very quickly was that their regular players rebelled, would not play the game. And so their revenue started to plummet. And what they realized soon after that is that they were actually, in the long run, making more money than they had previously at their blackjack tables because people were drawn to the idea of a beatable game. And so what they wanted to do was to keep intact the myth of beatability while making it more difficult for the few actually skilled players to take money out. And they tried a couple different things, including moving from one deck or two decks like they used to deal from traditionally to six decks or eight decks, which is what you see more today. They thought, because they didn't understand necessarily the mathematics of card counting very well, that it would be impossible to count cards to beat these games. Some still believe. I've encountered casino people who still believe that card counting involves perfect recall of every card play, which is just not really ever the case. And what they ended up inadvertently doing in creating these what are called shoes, these six and eight deck games, was creating new opportunities. So they created games in which when a deck became positive, favorable for the player, it would last for minute after minute after minute, as opposed to just being shuffled away instantly the way a single deck is when it's hot. And that created the possibility for team play. So their moves to eradicate card counting have inadvertently created new opportunities for it.
So give me an idea, if I were to know what to look for and I were to see Mossad playing, how many people would I see? Would I see them signaling to each other, get on this table and bet? Would I see disguises or people acting like drunks? Would I see all that stuff?
You would probably see a lot of those things depending on the type of session you were watching. Like MIT, we would do different things as appropriate, including sometimes sending people in on their own to play casinos by themselves. I played that way a good bit. But also the traditional team play, the call-in play, would involve usually four or so players, betting table minimum at different tables, and one big player who's the guy placing the large bets and whose job it is to come into the middle of the deck when signaled by one of the counters. And the big player will typically have a pretty strong act. And if you were watching Mossad, you would have seen almost any kind of act you can imagine. There were people dressed as sheiks pretending to be, you know, oil billionaires.
Uh-huh.
There were people acting certainly drunk and drugged and out of their minds. I acted out of my mind a good bit. There were some people who simply actually blended in almost like ordinary casino gamblers very, very well.
Yeah.
John Roth, the sort of leading figure who I describe in the book, was an incredible card counter. And he did many things that I just thought were tremendously awesome that I was never able to do myself because I never quite blended in with the ordinary casino people. But he was able to do it. One thing I saw him do once that I thought was wonderful was he was actually playing a double deck game and had bet egregiously. Like, I think walked into the middle of the deck betting two hands of table max, which is $1,000 at a small casino in Las Vegas. And the count dropped, so he just stopped betting. And not only did he stop betting, when sometimes card counters tend to be sheepish, like, mm-hmm. they don't want the pit to notice that they've yeah. lowered their bet. Instead of doing that, Roth turned the volume up and started screaming at the pit that he demanded a bottle of Dom to be brought to the table right now. And until they brought the Dom, he was going to refuse to wager, screaming out loud, "I refuse to wager," over and over again. So those sorts of hijinks are what you might have seen.
Right. That sort of creates the distraction, and the pit says, "We got a problem." They think the problem's the guy with the champagne. Their problem's really that he knows how to count those cards.
Exactly. And if yeah. you're able to introduce new problems into the mind of the pit, to get them thinking about other things than card counting, that can go a long way.
So look, we have this is all fascinating, and I want to really fast forward to your personal demise, which after all this, after all this success with blackjack, online poker was your undoing. How? Why?
I'm not sure I understand totally, although I've narrated it in some detail in Repeat Until Rich. By the way, the irony of that title was not totally intentional. The book was pitched and sold before I had any online poker experience. It was in the process of trying to become this other thing that I also wanted to be in the same sort of whimsical fantasy way that I used to want to be a blackjack player. It was in the process of trying to learn how to write that I realized I didn't know how to do any of what I hoped to be able to accomplish. And had some time to kill, was looking to procrastinate, and was playing poker simply recreationally in
yeah.
the beginning.
But I can see the appeal, because you could say there's so much effort that goes into this blackjack thing. I should be able to make some money on online poker. People who put in a lot less time than I do at blackjack are successful at online poker.
Right. Well, poker's a complicated game. I mean, yeah. it's definitely beatable, but you have to really do some work. I do have friends who earn a living that way, or have in the past, and I know that it's doable. And for the very same reason that an ordinary sort of person who's not a card counter might be attracted to blackjack, for a similar reason I was attracted to poker, you're right. That myth, that idea, maybe I can do this. I knew that I didn't have the actual infrastructure, the real skill, but it was a whim at the beginning.
And the last question is, are you in GA? Do you do any gambling anymore? Wait, I know the answer to that. The New York Times took you to Atlantic City and you took them down for a few thousand recently.
Yeah, I'm told that I flunked out of Gamblers Anonymous.
All right. We've been speaking with Josh Axelrod, who was a professional poker player in his book.
Yes. Sorry.
A professional blackjack player. His book is Repeat Until Rich, A Professional Card Counter's Chronicle of the Blackjack Wars. Thanks very much for coming in, Josh.
Mike, thanks so much for having me.